You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, our guest author issues a rallying cry to take up pen and paper and start writing letters again.
First, now that primary elections and conventions are in the rearview mirror, things seem to have calmed down politically in Wisconsin, or have they? With just under 100 days to go until Election Day, both presidential candidates will likely make a push for Wisconsin's 10 electoral votes, and at least one candidate will be making an appearance in the state this week.
That said, there's some debate over whether or not Wisconsin will matter as much this time around. But our next guest says the state could still play a prominent role in the coming months.
Matthew DeFore joins us now. He's a state capitol reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal, where he's been covering the presidential race. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Rob, thanks for having me back.
Well, Matt, in our last bunch of presidential elections, Wisconsin's gotten a lot of love and advertising money. People see us as, you know, could go either way, but it keeps going Democratic. What's the thinking this year? Are we going to see that kind of a hard push from both candidates?
Yeah, so far, I think it remains unclear exactly what we're going to see, but there are early indications, certainly, that both candidates are looking to Wisconsin. We've got Donald Trump coming to Green Bay on Friday for a rally in the evening. We also saw the Clinton campaign was going to hold a rally here shortly after she clinched the nomination with President Obama, but that got sidetracked. It was scratched because of the Orlando shooting, but certainly both of those things signal. And we also had Mike Pence, the GOP vice presidential nominee, here in Waukesha last week. So again, these are signs that the campaigns are looking at Wisconsin as an important state.
You talked to some pundits and prognosticators. You've been watching the polls here in the state. What are things looking like? Is this looking like a close race 100 days out?
Well, certainly we're seeing the polling now come out after the Democratic convention last week. Last week we saw the Republican convention. There were national polls showing the race tightening significantly. But now we're seeing that the Clinton campaign is, I think, getting more of a bump coming out of their convention. So, whether Wisconsin is going to be that close, we won't really get a good indication perhaps until next week when we see the Marquette poll. They did a poll before the conventions showing that, while the race was certainly closer than it was last year into early this year when Clinton had, double-digit, 9-point lead, it's gotten a little bit tighter. But this state has gone Democratic for the last 7 presidential cycles. Donald Trump isn't exactly, he lost here in the primary, as did Clinton, but there's a general sense that Wisconsin's going to still go Democratic for the presidential election, but it's such a weird and wacky election cycle, anything's possible.
And that's the thing a lot of people seem to be pointing to is previous rules may not apply this time around, but largely because of Donald Trump.
Right, and he did. He did win 2 congressional districts in the state, in the west and on the northern part of the state. And so we might, part of the thinking is that he has this appeal among working class white voters. And so, Wisconsin is certainly at this point not a battleground state like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Florida might be, or certainly are being talked about. North Carolina is another one. We're seeing the candidates go to Nevada quite a bit. But one person described Wisconsin as potentially a skirmish state where we're maybe in this sort of second tier, maybe not top 5, but maybe in the bottom 5 of the top 10. And, that still means we're going to see perhaps quite a bit of the candidates and their surrogates.
Talking to Matt DeFore from the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at the question of whether or not Wisconsin is going to be a hotly contested state in November's presidential election. Matt, you mentioned Ohio, Pennsylvania, and I think some of the thinking is Wisconsin's the kind of state that Donald Trump needs to win. He would need to win more states than Mitt Romney did. So maybe Midwestern states, manufacturing, but struggling manufacturing. You mentioned white working class voters. So this is maybe in the category that Donald Trump would need to focus on to win the Electoral College.
I don't think I'm hearing that it's a must win for Trump. I think it's certainly if Trump were to win Wisconsin, if he's putting together a map, it would certainly go a long way. And if he's doing well in Wisconsin, a state that has, like I said, gone for the Democrats the last 7 times, he may be well on his way to winning. But, he can construct a map without Wisconsin as well. So you know, maybe that's sort of the bellwether of what's really a swing state or a battleground state, is how significant is it in either candidate's strategy. And if Clinton wins Wisconsin, it's probably, you know, as expected. But if Trump wins it, it's a sign that he's doing quite well, maybe able to pull off the wins in the Rust Belt states that you know, certainly other Rust Belt states, certainly like Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania are critical for his strategy.
Do you think we're going to start seeing a lot of presidential spending here in the state when it comes to ads by the campaigns or by third-party groups? Or do you think there's going to be kind of a wait and see? They'll watch the next couple of polls, see if it's going to be close enough to justify that kind of investment.
Yeah, what I'm hearing is they're certainly going to be looking at the polls, and that we've got the Olympics starting Friday, too, so don't expect I don't know for sure if we'll see advertising during the Olympics, but people may not just be paying as much attention to the presidential race, today as they will be, you know, after the Olympics, after Labor Day, into October. What we do know is that when Hillary Clinton's campaign started advertising in 8 states, Wisconsin was not one of them, and we have yet to see Donald Trump's campaign advertising strategy in terms of which states he's going to focus on. But, you know, hey, we've got Sean Astin, the actor, coming into Wisconsin for the Clinton campaign tomorrow. And like I said, Trump on Friday. So those things, maybe they think of as attempts to get some earned media in the process. So
we've also got this race for Senate here in Wisconsin. Russ Feingold, Ron Johnson. Feingold, the previous senator hoping to return, has led in a lot of the polls. Do you see a lot of maybe piggybacking between those races? Clinton, you could see coming here, campaigning with Russ Feingold. Donald Trump and Ron Johnson campaigning together might be another story. How do you see that back and forth playing out?
Well, I mean, so far, Russ Feingold has... there's been some distance maintained there. He did not go to the convention last week. He stayed away from Philadelphia, whereas Ron Johnson initially said he was not going to go to the convention. He ended up going and giving a speech in prime time. So he also, at one point, I mean, I know the Democrats have really been, I think, really trying to link Johnson and Trump. At one point, I think he and Johnson himself said something about, like, there would be like the Ronald and the Donald show or something, or maybe the other way around. But that kind of linkage is, you know, it seems like both candidates in that race are having some weird relationships with their presidential nominees. And so, we'll see what Feingold does if Clinton visits. I guess if I had to guess which one would more likely campaign with their presidential nominee, I think I would pick Feingold at this point, but I'm not sure.
The conventions are done. We don't have to say presumptive when we're talking about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton now. What are you watching for next in this presidential race here in Wisconsin, Matt?
Well, certainly the polls, the Marquette Law School polls, which is, I think, what most people think of as like the gold standard here in Wisconsin, at least for now, is coming out a week. Professor Charles Franklin said he was going to be going into the field, I think, this upcoming weekend. So we'll see how the conventions have sort of shaken things up, or, you know, how things are settling after that. And then we go to the debates. I mean, it's going to be a lot of months of, could be any kind of, you know, controversy like we saw this weekend with the Trump campaign and his comments about this, the Gold Star family that spoke at the Democratic convention. I would think that the debates are the next big moment, kind of like the way that the convention was a big moment nationally. And so how people react to the debate. But as far as I can tell, the people I've talked to, the polls that come out after the convention tend to be the, you know, how the race shapes up over the next 3 months. And you're not going to see a huge amount of variation.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Wisconsin State Journal State Capitol reporter Matt DeFore. He joined us to talk about Wisconsin's developing role in the ongoing presidential election campaign.
Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll celebrate the lost art of letter writing. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look back at the history of the modern Olympic Games.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
When was the last time you wrote a letter? Patty C's mother made her write letters to her older sisters every week. It's that training that made her the writer she is today.
When I'm asked to do a craft talk in which I share with students or writers in training how and why I write, I sometimes say something smart-alecky. I'm a small-town gal with a poet's eye for details and a barfly's affinity for telling a good story. That may be true, but so is what I recently told a small crowd at a Chippewa Valley Writers Guild event. I am a writer because of my mother, who made me sit at the kitchen table and write letters with her at least once a week. As soon as I knew the alphabet, I wrote to my older sisters, who left home before I started kindergarten. This early training helped me see the story in my life, even at 6 years old. A lesson every writer needs is that this place is worthy of recording. For the last 4 years of Mom's life, she didn't recognize any of her 8 children or 16 grandchildren. Alzheimer's stole her memory and eventually her voice. The week before Mom died, my older sister Julie came home to say goodbye and brought along a small bag of letters Mom and I wrote to her beginning in 1972 when she graduated high school and moved away. Sometimes the universe gives us just what we need at exactly the right time. After Julie left, I spent hours next to Mom's deathbed reading these relics. The funniest parts I read out loud to her, though we could only communicate with touch. I massaged Mom's arms and legs, and she sometimes let out a slight groan. What a gift to see Mom's handwriting again, loopy but perfect cursive she learned from nuns at St. Killian's before she left school in 8th grade to help on the family farm. She wrote like she spoke, and though she lay before me, unable to move or even open her eyes anymore, in these letters I could hear her voice, an unexpected treasure. In one letter she wrote, "Jackie baked me an orange chiffon cake from Betty Crocker cookbook. It smells good. Wished you could be here to harmonize in the happy birthday song. We still close the drapes, put out the lights, light the candles, and sing." Active voice, concrete details. Her letters are a lesson in writing. Mom also wrote about the mundane, signing me up for swimming lessons even though I already knew how to swim, or driving with Dad to my brother's away football games so she could be there if he got hurt. Mom loved to write, and she loved her kids. Both are evident from these letters written decades ago. The day Mom died, I opened a letter I'd sent to Julie when I was 7 years old. "Guess what?" I said in my first line of big blocky printing. "Ann Landers got divorced, and Cher got married." I imagine Mom read the newspaper before we gathered at the kitchen table with our stationery and pens, and she shared with me these celebrity tidbits, pretty risque for 1975. All these years later, I can still hear my mother. "Write that down," she surely said to me. "Julie will get a kick out of this news."
Patty C. is a writer in Lake Halley. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
And continuing with dotting our I's and crossing our T's, our next guest echoes that call to take up pen and paper and start writing letters again.
Simon Garfield is the author of many books, including To the Letter, a celebration of the lost art of letter writing. Simon, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Really nice to be with you.
So you've tackled subjects near and dear to my heart. Recent books, I talked to you about maps a while back, fonts. Now you've done it again with letter writing. What got you started on thinking about letters?
Well, it's an odd thing, really, because it forms, I mean, you mentioned the other two books, and it does form the final book in a sort of accidental trilogy, in a way. So that all these books are concerned things that have been radically shaken up by the digital age. Typefaces, obviously, maps as well, and now letters. But I think this is the only one without a happy ending for me, anyway. It was really sparked when I read that more and more people were sending condolence letters, you know, notes of sympathy by email and text as well. I haven't heard of one by tweet, but that's probably just around the corner. And I thought, okay, well, you know, if you're sending condolence letters by text, then we've reached a pretty path, and it's probably time to kind of look back at and celebrate great letters and great letter writers, but also to question, well, are we really happy to abandon, you know, this great thing we've been communicating by letter for 2,000 years, and we're about to kind of throw it away without, I imagine, much, you know, too much thought, really. It's just, it's happened. It began, as we know, probably with the telephone, gradually, and then, especially over the last 10, 15 years or so, when obviously everyone's on email, we find that no one writes letters anymore. And the book really, you know, is concerned with how we're going to document our future history without letters.
And you're unabashedly pro-letter. You even write about loving the smell of them and the feel of them and the sort of whoosh
well,
that they make.
I mean, you make me sound very
romantic,
obsessional, Veronica. And that's not the idea. But no, I certainly love the feel of them, and I think that's something that we're sort of already beginning to miss, you know. I don't want to sound at all that I'm anti-email or text, or, and I kind of tweet as well, and obviously I use email as much as anyone else, and I couldn't have written the book because I interview a lot of people. I couldn't have contacted them so, you know, efficiently and quickly without email. So I'm not anti that at all. I'm just aware that we have a lot to lose. And,
let's talk about that. I mean, obviously, we have a lot of convenience when we use email and text, but what do we lose when we give up the letter?
Well, I think we lose a certain depth of writing, and I don't think we write with the same sort of emotion as we do when we send emails. You know, even before, you know, the Edward Snowden news and the NSA and before it was clear that, you know, more people than just the recipient were really reading our emails, I kind of felt uneasy about sort of, you know, expressing any great emotion or intimacy on a keyboard. There was just something kind of not quite right about it for me. So I think we don't write the same way. We also kind of, I think we write letters in a more thoughtful way. It's more of an effort and more of a process. You know, we sit down, we have an envelope ready, hopefully a postage stamp at the ready, and we think about things in a kind of longer form, you know, so not just instant responses as we would do, you know, in the digital way, but we would try and analyze things. Maybe we'll condense a week's news into a letter of a couple of weeks' news. And obviously the personal touch as well, you know, the handwriting and the kind of crossings out, all that character, I was going to say gradually beginning to lose, but I think we're losing it very fast.
Simon, I know as part of your research, you read lots of letters through the ages, and you came across some ones that were pretty special and stood out. Could you tell us about some of your favorite letters and letter writers?
Well, gosh, I mean, you know, a huge list. We could be here till Friday, but I think the first one that I think is extraordinary, the earliest one that I think is extraordinary, is a letter that Pliny the Elder wrote. Pliny the Younger wrote about the eruption of Vesuvius, and it's the only written account that we have of the eruption, and obviously fantastically you know, important event. And without that letter, we wouldn't have any details at all. And then, I don't know, you know, we jump 1,800 years or so, and I love John Keats's letters. As you might expect from a poet, he wrote in a very lyrical way, often wrote about his poetry, about his thoughts about the world, and, you know, as we know, died fantastically young, so there's an extra kind of pathos when he's writing to his, you know, his girlfriend Fanny Brawn from from Italy. He's gone to Italy because he's dying, and he's been advised by doctors that, that you know that's the best chance for him in the Italian air. And he writes, you know, extraordinary things. But I think my favorite set is a correspondence between two unknown people. I was very lucky to find this not long, actually, before I was due to hand the book in. A wonderful correspondence during the Second World War between a postman stationed in Greece and North Africa and his a friend of his in London as the bombs were about to fall. And the friend he writes to, and he writes just because he's bored, really on the off chance, he knew a little bit through work, but through their letters they fall in love. And it's a fantastic thing. So I thread the letters through the book, and it's a fantastic thing to read. And then it has a happy ending, and we know this because the letters were obtained from their two children. So an extraordinary thing, and I think it emphasizes the fact that letters are so much part of you know, ordinary people's lives as well as obviously well-known people's lives as well.
What is your, you know, in our last minute or so here, what is the most beautiful letter that you've ever gotten?
Oh gosh, I'm going to appear a bit slushy on you now, but I, you know, inevitably that would be a letter I received from my wife, and you know, I think you know, hopefully. You know, the majority, if not all, of your listeners will kind of think back to, you know, an early relationship or an important relationship and think about the mail they've received, you know, in those early days and hopefully still, you know, still have those letters as well.
All right. Well, Simon, thank you so much for being on and talking about letters with us today.
Well, I really enjoyed talking with you.
That was Simon Garfield, author of To the Letter, a celebration of the lost art of letter writing. And we've been talking about the importance of writing letters in a digital world.
Coming up, we'll look back at the highs and lows of the modern Olympic Games. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You might like to see, but they're all addressed to me. I wish I had a lot of answers. That's the way it should be. But all these questions be directed at me. I just can't find the time to write my mind the way I want it to read.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Rio is getting ready to raise the curtain on the 2016 Olympic Games. The modern Olympic Games were meant to be a celebration of manly virtue and a means to better humanity and enrich the spirit. At least that was the idea, according to the French aristocrat who revived the Games in the late 19th century.
Today, the Games are fanfare, glory, and a display of grit and athleticism. That's when they're at their best. But they've never been just that. The Games have always had a less uplifting parallel narrative with issues of race, politics, corruption, and performance-enhancing drugs.
David Goldblatt is with us now to talk about the history of the modern Olympic Games. He's taught the sociology of sports at a number of colleges and universities, including Bristol University. His latest book is called The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. David, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, let's start at the beginning. What was this French aristocrat, Baron de Coubertin's original vision for what we think of as the modern Olympic Games?
Well, his vision was, was a sort of neo-Hellenic athletic cult, one that was, you know, unquestionably for the Baron, religious or spiritual. I mean, he remarked that the ancients would find modern sports surprising that it had no religious or spiritual element. And what he was interested in celebrating was the sort of cult of athletic masculinity amongst the upper-class men of Northern Europe and the United States in the late 19th century, for whom sports in their educational institutions in particular was an instrument for generating esprit de corps and generating the right kind of body and disposition to go and rule the empire. And to pick up on your earlier quote of the Barons when he said that the Olympics should be a display of manly virtue, for which the reward should be the polite applause of women. So it's a really, you know, given where we are today and what, you know, that the Olympics is really about high performance and commercialized sport, it's a completely different world from the one in which we now live.
Can you describe what that first modern Olympic Games was like in the late 1800s?
Well, it was held in Athens in 1896, most of it in a single stadium, the Panathenaic Stadium, which was constructed, I think, in the 3rd century and had been recast with marble from a donation from a very rich Greek ship owner called Georges Averof. And there were 251 athletes. All of them were men, all of them were white men, and all of them, as I say, came from Northern Europe or the United States, and they were almost exclusively from upper-class backgrounds. I mean, I can tell you 90% of them have those extraordinary Victorian wax moustaches. And, you know, the people of Athens, it was an extraordinary event. For Athens, it was very much a very Greek moment rather than an international moment because, of course, present there in the crowd, you would have found most of Athens' high society and, above all, the Greek royal family. And the Greek royal family, you may or may not know, were, of course, of German descent and whose Greek credentials were certainly in question. And one aspect of the Greek Games was to, you know, unite the idea of the modern Greek nation with both the ancient Games and also this this Germanic royal family making themselves Greek in the process.
So, as you say, that bears very little resemblance to the modern Olympic Games that we think of that are about to kick off in Rio, and also not inclusive of women or minorities. So, looking back, what moments in Olympic history stand out to you as key to the struggle for the inclusion of those groups of people?
Well, I think about 1932 in Los Angeles, when Babe Didrikson, a fabulous, wisecracking, working-class woman athlete from Texas, comes out and not only wins 2 gold medals and a silver, but forces the American sports press in particular to reevaluate, you know, what a woman athlete can be, and to reevaluate the female athletic body, and to give her, you know, her dues, and to insist upon a measure of kind of respect that was not there before. So that's an extraordinary moment. And 1932 also offers, before we get to, you know, Jesse Owens, who is obviously remembered as a key moment for the African-American community and their representation in sport, you've got Eddie Tolan winning the 100 meters, the first African-American to be considered the fastest man in the world. And then really interestingly, you have the Japanese in 1932, who, you know, much of West Coast America, you know, is both scared of and looks down upon as little brown men who, you know, don't know how to play sport and are weak, kind of rice-eating. And then the Japanese show up and win nearly all of the men's swimming medals. And suddenly they have to be completely reevaluated. And one reads the diplomatic cables from the Japanese embassy in the United States saying, you know, for the first time, Americans are taking us seriously. And this is for winning the 200-meter breaststroke.
And the Olympic Games, they've also been used as a vehicle in a way to shine a spotlight on things like political issues. And I'm thinking of that defining moment with John Carlos and Tommy Smith raising their fists in the Black Power salute in the 68 Olympics in Mexico City. Can you tell us about that moment and how other political issues have also played out kind of similar to that at other Olympics?
Absolutely. I mean, if I can, before I talk about Smith and Carlos, it's worth remembering Bibi Bikila's moment. An Ethiopian marathon runner and a member of Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia's imperial guard. And he goes to Rome for the Rome Olympics in 1960. And, of course, Italy had conquered Ethiopia in the 1930s and subjected it to colonial rule. And here the empire was kind of striking back, and this Ethiopian guy in Haile Selassie's, you know, guard, who'd been exiled by the Italians, and he runs in the marathon, he runs in bare feet, and he destroys the field. And in fact, on his way
to the final line, he passes this extraordinary ancient Ethiopian monument, a sort of large obelisk with ancient writing on it that Mussolini's armies had stolen from Ethiopia and placed as a trophy in Rome. And he passes that in the lead, and then he passes under the great Arch of Constantine in the Roman Forum. And he's the first black African man to win a gold medal at the Olympics. So in terms of, you know, the bigger post-colonial struggle of the African diaspora, that is an extraordinary moment. And then, of course, 1968, you know, I think it's worth remembering that Smith and Carlos's moment comes on the back of over 18 months of protest within the African-American athletic community, organized by Harry Edwards and initiated over, you know, the informal color bar that existed for African-American athletes at San Jose in California, whereby you couldn't stay anywhere near the university to train because of the rental situation. And, of course, there was discrimination across the board in athletics and exclusion still of African-Americans from many elite athletic clubs. And so what, you know, is so important about that moment is that it comes out of a real social movement and a real struggle rooted in the civil rights movement and the struggle for civil rights in athletics. And what's it really, interesting about the moment as well of the salute is that initially it wasn't a huge amount of news. You would have thought, you know, in today's world, my God, it would have gone viral. The number of Twitter hits would have been gigantic. But in actual fact, there wasn't very much reporting of it until Avery Brundage, then IOC president, ordered the U.S. Olympic Committee to expel Smith and Carlos, which shamefully they did. And then it became news at that moment. And it's worth remembering, you know, it's an extraordinary moment, you know, given the situation both in Vietnam and the civil rights movement and the disgraceful record of the IOC itself on treating issues of race and diversity prior to this. So I think we have a lot to thank Smith and Carlos for creating that sort of defining image of struggle and of liberty.
We're talking with David Goldblatt right now. He's the author of The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. And David, let's fast forward now to these games that are about to unfold in Brazil. And this year, we've seen a number of issues dogging the lead-up to these games. We just heard in the NPR newscast about problems with waterways and raw sewage and displaced people. That one has been an issue that's been covered over the last several months. But how unusual are these kinds of issues as host countries and cities prepared to host the games?
Nearly all of the problems that Rio is encountering can be found in one or more Olympics, I would say, over the last 25 to 30 years. What is extraordinary about Rio is that it is giving everybody else a run for its money in each of those categories. And unlike the preparations for Sochi in Russia, or indeed for Beijing in China, you know, Brazil is an open society, and it's all on show in a way that none of them have had to cope with. So, for example, Athens, you know, I mean, Rio has got a problem with lateness, and it's got a problem with some white elephants, but it won't be quite as bad as Athens. Rio's preparations have clearly been, you know, subject to the most terrible forms of corruption and rake-offs of various kinds, but they're probably not quite as bad as Sochi. You know, dodgy infrastructure, incomplete, Olympic villages. I mean, we've been there many, many times over. Rio's, you know, is probably as bad as any. And then when you add all of these things together and the fact that the country is in the most severe economic recession, has undergone a constitutional crisis, the greatest corruption investigation in its history, it adds up really, I think, to the most, you know, I would tentatively say, as the IOC itself did in 2014, that this is the worst prepared Olympics that we have yet encountered. Not the most brutal. I mean, you know, a million people were displaced for Beijing 2008. You know, the social cleansing is probably not quite as thorough or as mean as Atlanta in 1996. But across the board, and given the context that Rio is in and the desperate sorts of needs in much of the city, I think it is perhaps the worst. It's certainly the one that is going to force the IOC and other potential hosts to think hardest.
David Goldblatt is with us right now. He's the author of the book, The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. And we're talking about the opening of the 2016 Olympics in Brazil and looking back at the highs and some of the lows of Olympic Games in the past.
And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Are you excited to watch the Olympic Games in Brazil? Do you think the problems of the Games overshadow the event this year or in general? Or do you feel a little bit of both? What kind of changes, what reforms would you like to see from the Olympics as they go forward? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll be back with this conversation after a short break here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And David Goldblatt is with us now. He's the author of the new book, The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. And we're talking about the opening of the 2016 Olympics coming up in Rio and looking ahead at the future of the Olympics along with its past.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch the Olympic Games while they're on? Do you look forward to them? Do you enjoy them? Do you worry about the downsides that our guest was talking about? Corruption, displacement of people, unsanitary conditions for the athletes. What do you think of the Olympics and what do you think needs to change, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And David, you used the phrase social cleansing before we went to our break there and also brought up that in context with the Atlanta Olympics. Can you tell us what you see happening in terms of social cleansing in Rio and what you saw before in Atlanta?
Well, it's worth remembering that in Atlanta, in the run-up to the Games, the police department was mass-producing dockets which were already had the boxes male, African-American, and homeless ticked. And then, you know, in alliance with a local NGO, were putting homeless folks on the bus to any family or address they could remember in the United States. I mean, it's pretty sort of hands down. And while, you know, of course, Atlanta was entitled to redevelop the rundown center of downtown, it's worth remembering that much of Atlanta's capacity to house the homeless in hospitals was destroyed in the process and never replaced. I mean, in Rio today, I know Al Jazeera have been reporting that in the area around Flamengo Park, where the sailing will be going on, a private company has been paid by a collection of local businesses to do sort of pretty much the same as a private security force. And we read of them, just taking complete liberties, wearing security outfits, but without the authority of the police, threatening to take people to police stations if they couldn't produce ID, which of course is completely illegal, and, you know, scaring folks off and cleansing it for the period of the Games. I mean, it's there. Seems to me very, very clear what's been going on in both Atlanta and Rio. And it's they're not alone in this. I mean, this goes all the way back. You know, Berlin, did the same thing. Tokyo cleared the Yakuza gangsters and the homeless from the Central Park. Mexico City told its poor to paint its shacks in multicolored paint, you know, to hide themselves. So Rio is not unique in this. I'm afraid we've had a lot of this before.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Michael on the line in Milwaukee. Hi, Michael.
Hi. My comment is, in listening to some of the recent talk that I was hearing, even more so, is I think the time for the Olympics has come and gone. I'm not looking forward to it all. I'm 70 years old. I remember back years and years ago where it seemed like people really would get keyed up about the Olympics because it was a smaller world. Now, with the world that we live in, in my mind, there's no reason to have the Olympics, and it always is nothing but controversy and problems and political propaganda. And a lot of the athletes are professional athletes anyways, and then they try and come out with all these new sports to try and get people's interest. So I think the Olympics has basically turned into a moneymaker, a private club, And I think its time has come and gone.
Okay, Michael. Wow, strong words from Michael, who says they're past their prime, riddled with corruption, and then a lot of the athletes are not amateurs at this point anyway. So a lot of charges there from Michael. What do you say to them? What do you think people, do you think a lot of people agree with Michael, David?
I think increasingly this is the case, you know, and you can see it in the formation of both anti-Olympic movements who've been protesting against the Games in Rio as well as very much in Vancouver in 2010. But the most telling thing is the number of cities that are prepared to bid for the Games. In 2020, for the 2022 Winter Games, the IOC was left with the rather unenviable choice of Almaty in Kazakhstan or Beijing in China, which was 180 miles from the nearest mountains. And this is after Oslo had withdrawn, Stockholm, St. Moritz, because wherever publics are given any kind of opportunity at the moment in the process, they're pulling out because they can see what happens. I mean, I would like to say, you know, I mean, like your caller, I'm struggling to find, you know, to find joy and to find purpose in the exercise as the kind of, you know, the count of problems increases. And I think if we are, and I do think there is real value in having a kind of cosmopolitan celebration of humanity through sport, but we're going to need unbelievable levels of reform and transformation, you know, in the IOC itself, as well as the way, you know, it conducts the bids, what it asks of its hosts, and the way the whole thing is run. I think there is a small window of opportunity reform, but I see it closing very rapidly.
And Michael, thanks for that call. And David, just briefly, it sounds like, as you were hinting at, that fewer and fewer countries are interested in stepping up at all to host the Olympics, at least looking shortly down the road in the next 8 years.
Well, look at 2024. I mean, and this is conducted under the new rules that President Thomas Bach, the IOC, effectively drew up, which is designed to make it a little bit easier, more of a dialogue with host cities rather than a sort of McDonald's-style franchisee relationship. But we only have four bidding for the 2024 Games. Rome is almost certainly going to withdraw because the new mayor is part of Beppe Grillo's five-star populist movement, and they're very much against the hosting of the Games. Budapest, I think, is a make-weight. So we're down to Los Angeles and Paris. And, you know, there are very few cities in the world like Los Angeles that can say, you know, UCLA, University of Southern California dorms, there's your Olympic Village, you know, and virtually build nothing like they did last time. So I think there is, you know, there beyond that, it's looking difficult. And I think rightly so. And the time for reform, really serious reform, has come.
Let's take one more brief call here from Linda in Madison. Linda, hi.
Hi. Yes, oh, yes. And I was going to say that Paris is not looking great at all in terms of security, so that'll be another issue. But I wanted to know what your book says about the role of gender and Olympic sport. In particular, this may be the first Olympic Games in a long time that the IOC will be unable to enforce some limitation on the characteristics of women who participate in Olympic sport, with the Duty Chan decision from the court for arbitration on sport. So I'm just interested on where you think the gender issue is going, which not only includes limitations on the people that the IOC recognizes as female for purposes of competition.
Linda, thanks for that. And David, just briefly, we've got about a minute left.
Well, I would say, as I say, you know, I begin when I describe the Olympic Games, you know, that it begins as 250 white men. And one of the extraordinary things about the Games is the lens it offers us for the struggle for women's inclusion in sport, for women's opportunity to find the meaning of sport for themselves rather than as a kind of purely masculine phenomena. And I try and trace that through the book, both the practical political organization of the Women's Olympics in the 1920s, which forced the IOC to incorporate women's athletics and gymnastics for the first time, as well as the struggles over
demeanor, sexuality, the disgraceful record of the IOC over gender testing through the 1970s and 1980s, and I try and bring it up to date with today's debates about testosterone, intersex athletes, and again, the debate over, you know, women's representation as we approach almost 50%.
And we leave it there. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Goldblatt is the author of The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. The 2016 Olympics kick off this weekend in Brazil. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.